Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Juan Cole. He's a professor of modern Middle East history at the University of Michigan and author of the blog Informed Comment. His most recent book is Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, published by Palgrave Macmillan. And he will be in Santa Fe this Friday, October 26th at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe in a free lecture entitled Steps Toward Peace in Iraq. It's part of the College of Santa Fe's Beyond the Lecture series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So I thought we could actually talk about your book. You'll be talking about Steps Toward Peace in Iraq on Friday, but let's go back to a very interesting period in history that I didn't even know about. I did not know that Napoleon even invaded Egypt. Let's go to 1798. The French Revolution had happened less than a decade earlier. What was the political situation in France at that time with respect to the goals and ideals of the French Revolution?
The French Revolution faced fairly severe external threats. The Austrians, the Germans, the British, the Spanish, all were very much dead set against this outbreak of republicanism in their midst. And they invaded. And the young republic had to fight off this set of powerful enemies. A young general, Napoleon Bonaparte, was sent off to confront the Austrians in northern Italy, where the Austrians ruled, and did brilliantly, defeated a very powerful state-of-the-art army, and became viceroy of Italy and emerged as a major figure in France itself. And so, the Republic itself had internally faced a sort of a back and forth between radicals and conservatives, and people were wondering whether Bonaparte would use his military prominence to enter politics.
What was the nature of Republican government in France versus the previous monarchy and the monarchies all around?
Well, the Republic had gone through these phases. First, they had a cohabitation, really, with the king, and then they decided to execute the monarch, and they decided that in 1792, carried it out early the next year. So that decision really was one of the things that caused the Austrians in particular to launch the war, because the Austrian monarch was related to Marie Antoinette, who was executed. Then you had this period of the terror when Robespierre and others were persecuting anyone that they suspected of royalist or religious tendencies. And they were very suspicious people and executed by guillotine large numbers of persons, politically banned others. And then there was a reaction against that terror. By 1795, what was called a directory government had been established, which was more kind of moderate middle class. But the rancor between the sort of the far left and the right remained there, and the directory kept tinkering with the election results to avoid either royalists or Jacobin, the far leftists, from dominating the parliament. So because they kept tinkering with the election results, they undermined their legitimacy.
You quoted in the book a French politician and revolutionary, Charles Maurice de Talleyrand, as saying that the energy unleashed by the American Revolution, he'd spent some time in the United States, was consumed by taking over the North American continent, and therefore there were fewer internal conflicts, whereas in France the internal hatreds and conflicts were very bitter. And it was an interesting comparison, and it made me wonder if a successful revolution is, by its nature, inevitably followed by one type of conquest or another, or indeed just that kind of terribly bitter strife.
Well, it certainly is one strategy that the elites can adopt, that if they have a lot of internal division, and there's the threat of civil war, to project those energies and those hatreds outward onto an external enemy. And it's very interesting that Taliban really conceived of the invasion of Egypt and the establishment of a sort of weird French Republican Empire as in part a solution to these unresolved conflicts between the left and the right in France. And he, as you say, drew on his experiences in the United States, where he felt, there hadn't been so much of rancor between the Jeffersonians, say, and the Tories in the aftermath of the American Revolution. In part, he thought, because people were pioneering to the West, and I presume he thought they were displacing those hatreds onto the Native Americans. Obviously, that strategy is, if he's right about it, also deeply flawed.
So Napoleon Bonaparte was a young man, not even 30 years old. Tell us more about how he got the job of invading Egypt, and more about the motivation for actually doing this.
Well, Bonaparte was from Corsica, and so he was from an island in the Mediterranean, and he therefore looked at the problems facing France differently than a lot of people in Paris did. Paris was very oriented towards the European continent. Bonaparte was thinking about the Mediterranean and about geopolitics. So by 1797, with his victory over Austria in Italy, Bonaparte really was facing only one major enemy anymore. The Spanish withdrew from the fray. The Austrians were contained. The Germans had withdrawn. But the British were still very anti-revolution, anti-French. They were attempted occasionally to blockade French-held ports on the continent. And they controlled the seas. And they had defeated the French in a kind of 18th century world war. We call it in the United States the French and Indian War, but it was actually fought all over the world, and it was fought in India as well, and the British defeated the French in India, so that France lost its Indian colonies. Bonaparte was thinking to reestablish a French empire, in part as a way of thwarting British imperial designs and weakening the naval power of the British. So he thought, if you take Malta and you take Egypt, you turn the Mediterranean into a French lake, and then you can threaten the British position in India itself, because communications between India and Britain, one of the routes that they could go that was shorter was through Egypt. So he had this grand strategy in mind. And he also thought the Ottoman Empire, and Egypt was a province of the Ottoman Empire, the Muslim-ruled empire from Istanbul, was weakening rapidly and probably would fall apart soon. And he thought that the European imperial powers would pick up the pieces, and he was determined that it not be Britain or Russia that got Egypt, but rather it should be France. So he kind of viewed himself in a race with the decadence of the Ottoman Empire.
How far back did the conflict between France and England go?
Well, the two powers had been rivals for a long time, but whether they were in profound conflict with one another differed from decade to decade. But the outbreak of the French Revolution had made them real enemies. And remember that the French had already gotten on the wrong side of the British by supporting the American revolutionaries. And then they had this revolution that challenged the whole principle of monarchy, the British government was determined, if it could, to strangle the French Republic in its cradle.
If the competition with England hadn't been there, do you think that France would still have gone to conquer Egypt?
No, I really don't think so. I think that the Egypt expedition was aimed at Britain, and in fact, they had a choice in winter of 1798 whether to try to cross the Channel and attack Britain or Ireland, or then to do Egypt, and they sent Bonaparte up north to see what he thought about the possibility of crossing the Channel, and sided against it. They decided they wouldn't be successful and that it was better to pursue the Egypt option.
So a huge number, tens of thousands of soldiers and sailors and others went on this mission to Egypt. Where did they go? How did they get there? And what happened when they got there?
Yeah, altogether it was slightly over 50,000 persons who went, if you count everybody, soldiers, sailors, merchants, hangers-on, and so forth. It was an enormous, the size of a large city at the time, enormous number of people. And they went on several hundred vessels. There were 14 enormous ships of the line, but then lots of corvettes and skiffs and smaller vessels. And they assembled in Marseille and Toulon on the Mediterranean in May of 1798, and people talk about the view from Toulon. If you looked in the bay, it was just jostling with all of these vessels. It was just an enormous flotilla, and they set off in late May, and it took them all of June to get to Alexandria in Egypt, where on July 1st, Bonaparte began offloading his troops. Because he wasn't able to offload his heavy artillery so quickly, they went ahead and marched on the port city of Alexandria with small guns and their muskets, and they didn't have much of a cavalry either. But they found the city largely undefended. There were a few cannon, but they were fixed in the wall and couldn't swivel, so weren't very maneuverable. And they made short work of the Egyptian military and took the city in a day. So Bonaparte was very pleased that he thought this expedition was going to be quite easy.
And where were the British in all of this?
Well, the British had a big fleet, also 14 ships of the line, commanded by Admiral Horatio Nelson. And they had gotten wind that Bonaparte was up to something in the Mediterranean. They weren't quite sure what. So Nelson took his fleet into the Mediterranean and was searching for Bonaparte's fleet. He miscalculated. He thought that Bonaparte was ahead of him. In fact, he got ahead of Bonaparte. And so he arrived in Alexandria before the French and inquired, and the Alexandria said, no, the French hadn't been there. So then he thought, well, maybe they're not going to Alexandria in Egypt. Maybe they're going to the Syrian coast. So he took his fleet over to Syria. And meanwhile, then the French did show up and take Alexandria. So Nelson would have ultimately to circle back around. It would take him a month to then take on the French fleet off of Alexandria.
We're talking to Juan Cole. So Napoleon and his people take the city in one day. What do you do once you've taken a city and it's quote-unquote yours? What happens next?
Well, Bonaparte used the same techniques he had used in Italy. He basically told these people that they were now Republicans. They were now partaking of the institutions and ideals of the French Revolutionary Republic. He proclaimed their rights. He made them wear tricolor decorations called cocades, these, or actually even be draped in a French flag. And he appointed especially the religious leaders to be the leaders of what he conceived to be as an Egyptian republic, a kind of sister republic to France. And he printed up pamphlets propagandizing the middle-class Egyptians that he hadn't come there to harm their interests. He wanted to displace the military junta that ruled the Egypt on behalf of the Ottoman Empire. He said he would bestow liberty on them, a concept with which they were largely not familiar and were somewhat puzzled. Did he mean that he was going to free the slaves, or what was this liberty he was talking about? They weren't quite sure. But then, having taken Alexandria, Bonaparte wanted to quickly march down the Nile a few hundred miles to take the inland capital of Egypt, which is Cairo.
Now, you wrote that Napoleon was a great propagandist, and you're talking a little bit about the propaganda, but did people buy into it? I mean, to what extent did they believe what he was saying, and to what extent was there any truth to it?
Well, a lot of his propaganda was quite fantastic. I mean, he maintained to the Egyptians that the Ottoman Sultan, the Ottoman ruler, had asked him to go to Egypt as a favor and overthrow its military government, a government that hadn't been paying its tribute as vassals to the Ottoman ruler very recently. And it is said in the chronicles that some of the Egyptian peasants actually believed this, that Bonaparte, you know, represented the Sultan. Of course, in fact, the Ottoman rulers were furious that the French had taken one of their provinces. And then Bonaparte tried to convince the Egyptians that, you know, the French ideology religiously was deism at that time, that there is one God, but it's kind of a clockmaker God. The God made the world, and then, you know, you don't hear so much from him after he made the world. And so they rejected the Christian Trinity. They rejected direct revelation. They rejected the church hierarchy, and in fact had more or less deposed the Pope when they were in Italy. So Bonaparte propagandized the Egyptians that given that they all believed in one God and given that they were opposed to Trinitarian Christianity and the Catholic hierarchy, that, you know, the French deists weren't so different from Muslims. In fact, you could even say they were a kind of Muslim. So we have reactions from Egyptian thinkers to Bonaparte's proclamations, and it's very clear that they thought that they were a load of horse manure.
There's something I find very strange. Maybe I shouldn't, but it's the coexistence of Enlightenment philosophy and the brutality of conquest. I mean, you have, you know, Napoleon and all these people around him talking about art and science and literature at one moment and burning down villages in the next moment. Help us understand that.
It is a contradiction because the French Republic had proclaimed the rights of man. And very famously, they had not proclaimed it with regard to French citizens. The rights of man were considered universal, somewhat the way the U.S. Declaration of Independence is worded. You know, all men are created equal.
Right.
All men have certain inalienable rights. Well, that was the same kind of discourse you had in France. It was a universal ideology. And so you would think that the French Republic would be reluctant to deprive people of their rights. But Bonaparte, as a general, really ruled and administered and punished as a military man without regard to civil law or to these high ideals. And I'm not sure he himself was very committed to them even at that point. If villagers rebelled, he ordered the village burned and the men killed. He did this over and over again. It's in his letters. In fact, an earlier generation back in the 20s of French historians tended to dismiss his orders in this regard as unlikely to have actually been carried out or an exaggeration on his part, or they couldn't believe how brutal it was. But the memoirs of the other officers make clear that, that he really did do these things, that he ruled in a very severe way. Some of his officers became disillusioned as a result of those who were especially committed to the ideals of the French Revolution, Enlightenment philosophy, began murmuring that Bonaparte was acting like the old monarch he used to act in France, or indeed was acting like a typical Middle Eastern tyrant, so that he had represented himself as going there to bring these Western ideals, but in a way fell victim to the brutality of his surroundings. This is the way the memoirists depicted it.
Now, did Napoleon Bonaparte understand the culture of the people or the cultures of the people whom he was conquering?
Well, Bonaparte had a certain understanding of the Muslim world and the Arab world. Being from Corsica, I think, you know, he had a window on the southern Mediterranean, and so it wasn't a world that was so alien to him. And when he was young, he had a thing about Middle Eastern culture. He read a lot of books on Middle Eastern history, and he even wrote a short story set in medieval Iraq about a veiled prophet who arose and introduced a turmoil into a kingdom, and the caliph of the time, who represented reason and progress, had to put down this this irrational figure. So he was, in some ways, very steeped in Middle Eastern history and culture, and admired it. He admired the Prophet Muhammad, unlike a lot of his contemporaries. He rebuked Voltaire for his play, which vilified Muhammad, and he was aware of the Arab immense contribution to sciences and scientific progress in the medieval period. So, you know, in some ways, he knew a lot about the region, but in other ways, of course, he hadn't lived among Muslims and so didn't know so much about their practical customs and everyday culture. He had book learning.
So how did France go about forming and administering a government in Egypt in a place where they were admittedly not that familiar with the local ways of life and of governance?
Well, the French depended heavily on Egyptians to guide them. They conquered Cairo, and there were probably on the order of 30,000 French soldiers in the city, which had a population at the time of probably 250,000. So, and they were heavily armed, and so people tended to be willing to cooperate with them, at least in the beginning. And so Bonaparte asked the Muslim clergymen, the Sunni Muslim clergymen of Egypt, who had a great deal of moral authority with the people, to form the core of an Egyptian republic. And so there's a sense in which Bonaparte invented the Islamic Republic, because these clergymen said, well, okay, we'll cooperate and set up this government for you, but we'd like to apply Muslim law, Islamic law. And Bonaparte, in his letters, assured them that that would be fine with him. So this whole project of having a republic that implements Islamic law, which we see nowadays in Iran, an overthrow of monarchy and a replacement of it by clerical authority and Islamic League Republic ideology are there in the way that Bonaparte ran France. And it's very ironic because, of course, in France itself, the government was very anti-religious.
We're talking to historian Juan Cole. So what was the nature of the resistance to the French invasion in Egypt, the Egyptian resistance?
It's clear from the memoirs of the officers and soldiers that survived that the Egyptians deeply disliked their French conquerors and frequently rebelled against them. The French, I think, were a little bit surprised at how common firearms were among Egyptian villagers and Bedouin. They estimate that about 15% of the villagers had muskets. And, of course, the Bedouin most often had carbines that they could fire from horseback or camelback. So the Egyptians sniped at the French all the time they were in Egypt. You know, the French soldier would be walking down the street of a city like Rosetto or Cairo and would just fall down dead because he'd been shot. Or out in the villagers, Bonaparte would send the soldiers out to collect taxes, which really meant kind of robbing the peasants of their livestock and crops. And the peasants would frequently snipe at them. They would shoot at them as they were going up the Nile in their boats. And sometimes a boat would arrive, you know, with half the number of soldiers that had set out because they would just be shot and fall into the Nile. So there was a constant attrition of French soldiers, both from the peasantry and even more vigorously from the Bedouin, all the time they were there. And then from time to time, there were major urban revolts. The city of Damanhour revolted more than once. The city of Cairo in October of 1798 staged a massive uprising that probably left dozens, if not hundreds, of French troops dead. Bonaparte, I think, tried to cover up the extent of the French losses, but it certainly that uprising threatened the very existence of the French in Egypt and was put down by cannonades. Bonaparte just fired cannonballs into urban crowds to put it down with great brutality, and that revolt of October 1798 was a joint urban-rural production because the villages around Cairo and up into the Delta and the Bedouin all joined in to attack the French simultaneously. So the French had much better guns. They had heavy artillery. They had good drill and tactics. They were always able to put down the direct revolts against them. But they, over time, just continued to face attrition.
The whole period we're talking about is very short. The occupation was over by 1801. What happened?
Well, first of all, the French fleet off of Alexandria was attacked by Admiral Nelson and his ships and defeated. A number of the French ships were sunk. Others were captured. A few others managed to flee back to Malta or France. So the French army was trapped in Egypt as of early August of 1798 without the hope of reinforcements coming from France or new equipment and so forth. And Bonaparte was eager to break out of that trap, and he attempted in spring of 1799 to out through Syria, to take Ottoman Syria, and possibly even, it might have been in his mind, to go overland towards Iran and India and threaten the British in India. But he was unable to take the city of Acre, which had an old crusader fortress that he couldn't reduce, and the Ottomans held it. And so he came back to Egypt in summer of 1799 and saw that he was blocked. And in late August, he slipped out of Egypt and managed to get back to France. And there he had done a lot of propaganda that the conquests in the Orient were glorious, and people had believed that. And he used his supposed victories in the East as a platform for making a coup and coming to power in November as first consul. And, of course, he had abandoned his troops in Egypt, who were quite sullen about it. And they were there for two more years holding the fort. But eventually the Ottomans and the British made an alliance, and the British gave naval support to an Ottoman expeditionary force, which came into Egypt, defeated the French. And the French, having surrendered, were then taken back to France on British vessels.
You talked earlier about the French, I don't know if it was perception or propaganda, that the Ottoman Empire was in a state of decay. and therefore Egypt would be relatively easy to take. What was the truth of that? Was the Ottoman Empire in a state of decay?
Well, in and of itself, the Ottoman Empire was pretty ramshackle. But it was, at that time, attempting to modernize. The Sultan, Selim III, was importing European tactics of drill, European artillery. He was trying to modernize the military. The Ottomans were trying to reassert themselves in the provinces, and they would succeed in doing so to some large extent in the course of the 19th century. So I think Bonaparte's pronouncement of death on the Ottoman Empire was a good century premature. Many of the processes that Bonaparte saw happening didn't become dire until World War I. And so he was right, but he was right a century and a half later, or century and a quarter later. And so his idea that the Ottoman Empire was ripe to be dismembered by European colonists, would be acted upon in the course of the next century, and there was some truth to it. But he jumped the gun on that, and the Ottomans were able to respond to the French attack effectively by making alliances with the Christian powers, with Britain and Russia in particular. And that was a multipolar world, so this Ottoman willingness to ally with the Christians was very effective.
So Napoleon went back to France, and just a few years later, he was emperor. What was the process by which revolutionary, anti-monarchy, rights of man, Enlightenment France became Imperial France?
Well, I think that's a complex a subject, and there are many debates about it. But first of all, the Republic of the 1790s was awfully unstable. There was this severe divide in society between the left and the right, and neither really trusted the other. And that was one of the reasons for which the executive kept tinkering with the outcome of elections. They didn't want too many Jacobin leftists or pro-monarchy rightists to end up in Parliament. So the instability, the constant threat of coups, the parliamentary tinkering, all of those left people unsettled and unsure, and I think there was a certain yearning for order. And the other thing was that because the Republic was attacked, and because it successfully fought off the attacks with a conscripted army generaled by revolutionary volunteers often who then went up through the ranks, the top generals had been in military academy but had thrown in with the revolution. The process of protecting the Republic from its external enemies threw up a military-industrial complex of a sort, an 18th-century version of it. There were all these military contractors. There were people who had an interest in making money off of war. There was an officer class that was getting promotions because it was doing well in war. And a kind of war party formed. And I think those people didn't have the time of day for civilian politicians. And so Bonaparte, had a constituency to come to power, and he was widely admired for his victories, especially in Italy.
What is the legacy, if any, in Egypt of this brief French occupation?
There's been a lively debate in Egypt ever since about the significance of the French invasion. There is a romantic nationalist narrative about the French invasion that it did bring this torch of modernity to Egypt, which had been, a kind of sleepy province of the Ottoman Empire. And so, the first printing press in Egypt itself was set up by Bonaparte for propaganda purposes. A lot of modern institutions and administrative techniques were introduced by the French for the first time. Enlightenment philosophy was taught to Egyptians for the first time, and so forth. Historians tend to be somewhat skeptical about these claims because it's not clear to in the historical record that most of the things that the French did in Egypt had any long-lasting significance. They took the printing press back away with them, and their administrative innovations were not followed through on. The Ottomans reasserted themselves. And so that narrative that Bonaparte kind of kicked off modern Egypt can be challenged on the facts. But it is still a powerful narrative. And in 1998, which was the bicentenary of the invasion, the Minister of Culture in Egypt actually was prepared to celebrate the bicentenary and jointly with Paris. And more nationalist Egyptians complained bitterly about this and held protests and stopped the bicentenary from going forward in Egypt. So people are still arguing in Cairo over whether it was a good or bad thing that it happened and what its long-term impact was.
Well, what about from the French point of view? Is there a palpable legacy in France of this period, of this invasion?
Well, it is a major event in French history, and so all French know about it, and French intellectuals are aware of it. And, of course, for France, for the history of France, in many ways, the Bonaparte expedition to Egypt was a precursor to French Algeria. And French held Algeria from 1830 to 1962. They declared it French soil. And administered it very heavily, and many, many French got their political experience in or military experience in Algeria. So Algeria was a very important part of French history, and to the extent that this whole investment of resources in a French empire in the Middle East began with Bonaparte in Egypt, it has that positioning as the initial gambit. And in France itself, I think there's been a tendency to focus on the civilizational encounter between the French and the Egyptians, the ways in which the French, Bonaparte took with him several hundred scientists and had the country thoroughly investigated. They measured the monuments and drew them and investigated ancient Egypt, modern Egypt, everything, and published a 32-volume description of Egypt, which is the foundational work in modern Oriental studies. So the French tend to focus on the ways in which the scientists discovered Egypt, and the narratives of brutality and repression and arbitrary rule that are all through the Egyptian chronicles and some of the memoirs of the officers tend to be downplayed. In fact, the French kind of have a wounded nationalism these days, and in 2005, the Parliament tried to pass a law that would force French school teachers to emphasize the positive aspects of French colonial history. And there was a big protest, and ultimately then-President Jacques Chirac rejected the law. But you can see how complicated this legacy is in France. And it also ties into the fact that now 5% of French residents are Muslim, and many Middle Easterners live in France and are French citizens. And so, in some ways, the question of Bonaparte in Egypt has been reversed. And the question of what is French person has now been broached.
Well, and we carry the BBC here on KSFR, and there seem to be fairly regular reports about the schools trying to ban Muslim schoolgirls from wearing headscarves. And as I was reading your book, I was wondering if the roots of it went back to, of this kind of thing, went back 200 years. You never hear about that in other European countries.
Right. Well, the French attitude towards things like Muslim headscarves is rooted in French debates about the position of religion in public life. They go back to the revolutionary period in the 1790s. The French Republic de-established the Roman Catholic Church, which had been the official church of France under the monarchy. And they, for instance, started appointing the bishops of the government, the French government, instead of letting the Pope do it. And they also took away the privileges and a lot of the land of the church. The more revolutionary elements took over the Notre Dame and celebrated reason in the Notre Dame, the cathedral, instead of Jesus and Mary. So that attitude, the French sort of secular, militant secular attitude, has been part of French politics ever since. And in the Third Republic, in the early 20th century, you couldn't be a member of the French cabinet if you went to Mass. It was expected that a government minister would be a secular person. So it's a very different idea about religion and state than the United States has. Our First Amendment protects religion from the state, whereas the French attitude is state should be protected from religion.
Right. We're talking to Juan Cole. His book is called Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East. What are some of the lessons that this piece of history can teach us today?
Well, I think the ultimate lesson of the failure of Bonaparte in Egypt was a failure of legitimacy, that it just proved impossible to convince the Egyptians that it was legitimate for the French to rule them. Of course, if one has overwhelming power, one can make a colonial empire stick with cannon and bayonets and shooting people and making them afraid, and of course co-opting them in various ways, promising them advantage and wealth. But gaining real legitimacy, convincing people that it's right that that they be ruled in this way, is awfully difficult. And Bonaparte failed in it, and I think most Western colonial ventures in the Muslim world have failed to gain basic moral authority.
Well, one does think of Iraq today.
Yes, I think that's another place where, when the United States first overthrew the Saddam Hussein regime, there were substantial numbers of Kurds and Shiites, even a few Sunnis, who agreed that the regime had been illegitimate and said they were grateful to the United States for getting rid of it for them. But then as the U.S. remained in Iraq, as years went by, and as the U.S. military essentially ran the country, the Americans lost that vote of appreciation. And the majority, vast majority of Iraqis in polls now view themselves as being occupied by a foreign power and want it, very much want it to withdraw as quickly as possible. So, maintaining any kind of legitimacy as a foreign ruler of a Middle Eastern Muslim people, I think is impossible, and certainly impossible in today's condition.
When you say today's condition, what is different? I mean, one thing that comes to mind is the reality of instantaneous international communications.
Yes, that was part of what I meant. But not just communication, because actually we underestimate the degree to which information traveled pretty quickly in pre-modern times as well. Gossip networks are important in pre-modern times, and indeed the French complained that the Bedouin, who traveled around the country and wandered about, had a kind of semaphore system. They communicated to each other events, and word spread quickly. So it's not just a matter of information spreading, but also of people being mobilized in certain specific ways. For instance, political parties, just the way that people are organized, is different. I mean, in Bonaparte faced a series of mainly rural villages in Egypt, which his soldiers could fairly easily overwhelm, usually. But in Iraq is a modern country with a big industrial base. They have pharmaceuticals, they have petrochemicals, they are educated people, they have political parties. And so ruling them from Washington, I think, is in the medium to long term absolutely impossible.
I've often thought that it must be particularly frustrating for historians like you to watch historical patterns repeating, especially when they come with terrible suffering, as they do century after century. Do you think that there is anything that human beings can do to interrupt these patterns and do things differently and with more genuine humanity?
Well, I think that there was a failure of imagination of the American people in supporting this invasion of Iraq. Most Americans don't know very much about the Middle East, but surely they knew that it's a fairly nationalistic place, and that it had, in Algeria and elsewhere, been characterized by violent anti-colonial movements in the late 20th century that ended the European colonial empire. So why anybody thought that you could revive empire in that region in particular is beyond me. And people like William Crystal, the Project for a New American Century, just seemed to me to be tone deaf about the region, its history, its own people's concerns. They managed to convince the American people to go along with what was always, I think, doomed to be a fiasco.
Well, Juan Cole, I want to thank you so much for being with us and hope to have the opportunity to talk to you at another time about current events. But thank you so much for talking all this time about your book.
I much appreciate it.
Juan Cole is professor of modern Middle East history at the University of Michigan and author of the blog Informed Comment. His most recent book is Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East. And he will be in Santa Fe this Friday, October 26th, at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe in a free lecture titled Steps Toward Peace in Iraq. It's part of the College of Santa Fe's wonderful Beyond the Lecture series. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website Santa Fe Radio Cafe, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.